There are two words that strike fear into almost every young student's heart: summer school. But many educators around the country are trying to change that. In fact, the goal could be to have students ask to participate in summer learning. The federal government has earmarked billions of pandemic relief funds to enhance summer school programs. That was the topic of a panel discussion at the Education Writers Association's virtual national seminar this May. The panel was moderated by Aaron Richards of USA Today and featured Jennifer Peck from the Partnership for Children and Youth, Ebony Johnson, Chief Learning Officer at Tulsa Public Schools, and Aaron Philip Dworkin, CEO of the National Summer Learning Association. And he'll get us started by explaining why summer school has become summer learning.
Summer school has been known and has had the reputation for being remedial, for being punitive, a punishment, for being mandatory, but only for a few students, and being academic only, restricted to academic content, and taking place within the four walls of a school building. Summer learning, the reason we use that term, is designed to be the opposite of all those characteristics. So instead of mandatory, we understand in COVID, we might need to make it mandatory, but the idea is to make it so exciting that it's voluntary and everyone wants to come. That it's not only for a few students, but open to everyone. That it's not just remedial. Sure, we have a lot to make up, but also students who want to learn more and take different kinds of classes or accelerate their learning or learn topics that they are not in the curriculum, don't fit in during the year, right? Also, it doesn't only have to be at the school. And this is what we're seeing a lot of districts. Boston is a great example where they use the city as a classroom, and you have certified teachers working in programs at the zoo and the science museum and cultural institutions running programs. So students get out in their community and see new things and opportunities for them. And this idea that it doesn't have to be, and shouldn't be, we promote not only academic, but that you're doing arts and enrichment and health and fitness and the social emotional support. So there's a lot there. Happy to elaborate more on it. But again, partnerships are key to what summer learning is about. Districts working with their other government serving youth agencies, parks and rec, libraries, public housing, as well as the other nonprofits and even the corporate sector around summer youth employment.
So this might be a question for either maybe you and Jennifer or either or, but I did a big piece on summer learning, talked about what districts around the country are doing. When I dug into a lot of the research, some of it was kind of mixed. It looked like, it wasn't just about having summer school, it's making sure kids come every day or come every regularly to whatever summer learning opportunity that you have. Based on what you guys know, does summer school work? Does it have measurable outcomes for academics? And if so, what should schools be measuring?
So I am not aware of any studies that have definitively shown that traditional remedial part day summer school is at all effective. What has been shown to be effective, and this has been affirmed over and over again, and in fact, just this past year through a major multi-year study by the RAND Corporation, is that the programs that are proven to get both academic and well-being and social emotional positive outcomes for kids are programs that, as Aaron alluded to, are blended staffing with teachers working in the academic portion of the program and community-based organizations doing enrichment and exposure and fun and all of the things that get kids to be there, and programs that are full day in nature and that go on for at least 5 to 6 weeks, and also for multiple summers. And so one of the things that was interesting about the RAND study showed that after one summer, they didn't see meaningful change in, I think it was in reading and in the social emotional, they saw a little bit of change in math, but over two summers, they saw positive outcomes on all of those measures. And so I think that's one of the things we really have to keep in mind as these federal recovery dollars are being spent out there, that we can't look at this as a one summer solution. And I think the research is pretty clear about that.
How many years are districts allowed to spend this earmark specifically for summer learning? How many years can they spread that out over?
They have three summers in which to spend.
Aaron, do you want to add anything to that about
And Jennifer knows, and she led a gigantic statewide effort in California with has a lot of great examples she could share. But again, just echoing that we have 3 years for the funding. And while we're sitting here on May 4th and people are going to do the best they can, we're trying to make sure that people build their summer planning into their year-round cycle of planning for school districts for the next few years. And that's the real opportunity we have here, not to just get some funding now at the end of the year and quickly try and plan, but that we have a chance to do it. And again, the evidence base is really strong for what works. We know what doesn't work too, but we know, like Jennifer was describing, and that RAND study looked at 5,600 students in 5 districts across the country for multiple years. And so there were a lot of lessons learned. And that, I think, set us up well for this opportunity, because we've been prepared. We have research. We know it works. We have good training. We have good infrastructure to handle the investment of resources. And now it's about executing it.
One thing I wanted to just add in on that the research really affirms and is also common sense is the importance of consistent attendance in these programs, which is necessary to get to any of the outcomes that we're looking for young people. And if you're not designing these programs around student interest and making it fun and making it feel like camp, kids aren't going to show up and families aren't going to be interested. And I think that's going to be especially important this coming summer as we try to rebuild the confidence of families to send their kids back into in-person structured environments. These programs really, really have to appeal to kids and families for them to show up and come every day.
Because one of the major problems here is that summer school isn't mandatory, right? So districts, I mean, they can't force kids to come, right? So their best carrot in that scenario is to make it really engaging and so that kids and families want to participate.
Absolutely. We want students to take ownership for their own learning. If it's only going to be adults dragging kids, kicking and screaming, we're never going to achieve any of the outcomes we're trying to get here. And so it's all about, it's also the time to exact, and I want to definitely hear from Ebony too and others, you know, just about setting people up for the coming school year. So, I mean, just some realities where vaccination rates are going up, you know, the summer months, it's safer to be outside in a lot of situations here. You can't even in some states bring 20 students into a classroom to be with one another. So a few things are pushing in our direction and a lot of districts are overwhelmed and exhausted. So all of this leads to more partnerships and the idea of using this summer to help set districts and schools and families up for acclimating with one another and getting excited to go back in person.
What are the things that don't work beyond like a half day program or something? Are there other sort of red flags for summer school planning that reporters may, you know, see early on that maybe the district is doing something that doesn't really have a good research base behind it?
You know, I feel bad because everything I say sounds so obvious once I say it, but unfortunately it's not always implemented. So if I'm going to tell you and remind us all that we are coming out of a very traumatic experience that has disproportionately affected low-income and communities of color. More people in the Latino community have lost their jobs 3 times more than white people in terms of unemployment, death rates from COVID in the African-American community, twice as high as they are in others. So depending on who you're working with, there has been real trauma. And so that leads to a line that we like to say, which is connection before content. You can't just welcome everyone back, encourage everyone to come back and not touch base with like, how's your life? Like, how's your family? What have you just been through? What is going on? And can we get some social workers and you know, the people who have real training and expertise in some of this to work in these programs and connect? And then we'll get to math and reading and science and STEM and all of this. But I just want to remind ourselves in our rush to just kind of run back to normal, that we have not been through a normal experience. And that's a certainly important message.
I would echo all of that. I think a red flag would be, regardless of the length of the program or how many hours, a red flag would be a program that is only focused on academics. And that's never a positive thing in a summer program. And as Erin said, I think it could absolutely backfire in very detrimental ways this coming summer as we're trying to re-engage young people. And I think something we really have to look for in summer programs this year are how well have the staff been trained to be able to receive students and support students who've had a lot of trauma this past year. I think the professional development and staff training aspect of how districts are planning is going to be really, really important.
And again, just to echo one last thing here is the arts are really important, the health and fitness and getting kids out into nature. All of those have research evidence to show that when students have those experiences combined with academics, they do better academically, and they do better than they would in an academic-only program.
Still to come, the conversation about summer learning continues with a look at how one Midwestern city is transforming their summer programs. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and today we're listening to a panel discussion on transforming summer school into summer learning. The virtual discussion was held during the Education Writers Association's national seminar in May and was moderated by Aaron Richards of USA Today. We've already heard from Jennifer Peck from the Partnership for Children and Youth and Aaron Philip Dworkin, CEO of the National Summer Learning Association. Now, Ebony Johnson, Chief Learning Officer at Tulsa, Oklahoma Public Schools, joins the conversation to talk about the summer programs in her city.
Before I jump into that, I just want to say I'm excited, one, to be here. Thank you, EWA. And then Jennifer and Aaron, I'm in the best company because everything you're saying, if you notice, I'm over here nodding and going, yes, okay. So I think that Tulsa Public Schools is going in the right direction. So to your question, you know, as the second largest physical school district in the state, we just believe that there's an urgent need for restorative and meaningful summer experiences for our young people. We've committed in an unprecedented way to investing in our young people and doing that this summer in a way that we've not done before. I would say the previous 2 to 3 years, we had about 4,000 to 5,000 students that were a part of our typical summer school, if you will. And they would come for several reasons. Students who lack credits, students who did not get the grades that they needed in order to go to the next grade level. We have RSA requirements, which is Reading Sufficiency Act for our third graders, and students would attend for that reason. And much to Aaron's point, it felt punitive. It felt like a mandate. It felt like something we had to do. This year is a completely different scope in that we are launching what's called Ready, Set, Summer, which is really us taking our ESSER and CARES dollars and expanding summer camps to all of the students in Tulsa Public Schools. So every single school will host a summer learning program, a summer camp program, where our students will have a split day. So half of their day will focus on still that unfinished learning, the academic supports that are still needed. And then the other half of their day will then, of course, open up for internships and STEM activities and clubs. So some of those things were mentioned, the arts and robotics and chess and journalism and so forth. So super excited about so many of those opportunities being afforded to our young people who, as Aaron stated, are underserved in many cases and are in critical need for engagement to happen from both the fall, the spring, and now into the summer. And so we're really excited about offering that. We're going to launch right as we finish out in our June, what we call June boot camp. So we're given a boot camp opportunity for our seniors who are struggling to finish their credits so that they can actually have supports to get that done. And then right after that June, we're launching into Ready, Set, Summer, which is all of our students engaged for a full 4 to 5 weeks of intensive supports.
And that's for K to 12?
Pre-K 12, absolutely.
And how many people do you have signed up so far?
Yeah, so again, numbers in the past was 4,000 to 5,000. Right now, we have an estimated 11,000. So we're excited about doubling. However, we have opportunity for over 30,000. So we are, much like a lot of other districts, just really trying to get to the address of our young people, get in touch with them. Them responding back to us has still been a struggle since we've been back in person. Making sure families get the information, making sure that we utilize all of our community partners to push the information out as well, so that our families know that this opportunity is there for them.
And I'm going to ask you this, and then I want to get Jennifer's take as well, because I know that she does a lot in terms of like kind of hooking up new partners together to make, you know, some of these meaningful experiences happen. Did you have to expand your staffing in new ways to the community? There was some talk about bringing in, you know, people that have some kind of passion that they want to sort of share with kids, that, you know, that they could do this, or teachers could pursue something with students that they may not normally teach in school.
I'll tell you, Erin, as we're getting into the work, we're going, ooh, this is big. Oh, no, this is huge. Oh, no, this is gigantic when it comes to like how many folks we're going to need to actually help us pull it off. So, yes, we are partnering in a much more intentional and in-depth way with our community partners. So we know our superintendent, our state superintendent, is also launching some statewide supports for summer. There's going to be some monies given to like our YMCA, like our Boys and Girls Clubs, in order for them to provide local school districts with support. Well, Tulsa Public Schools is also utilizing some of our own ESSER dollars and CARES dollars to fund some of our community partners to come in and provide additional supports for us as well. So yes, we will have community partners providing support, parks and recreation, some of our local churches, some of our local organizations who provide specialized activities that kiddos really get into, dance and the arts and so many other things. As far as coordination, it's been a cross-collaborative effort. So it's truly been cross-functional. We have all the way from our deputy superintendent, who's kind of spearheading this work at the very top, then my team of learning. So we're coordinating all of the learning efforts. We have designated individuals who are executives on our team, who's truly doing the organizing and planning for all of the details.
And Jennifer, I know you've also focused on these kinds of partnerships for a long time, particularly in California. Can you talk about either really well done partnerships that you've seen work and produce good outcomes for kids in the past, or something new that you're seeing happening across the horizon this year?
I think the partnerships and thinking really creatively about the partnerships is one of the most exciting opportunities we have in front of us right now with the new resources. And then, you know, also trying to grapple with this staffing challenge that a lot of school districts around the country are worried about. You know, typically districts would hire teachers to run these programs, and we're going to still need teachers, but teachers are really tired and fatigued from what they have also been through this past year and are going to need a break. And we're also losing teachers in record numbers to retirement because of burnout. And so it forces us to think more creatively about how we're going to staff these summer programs. And some of the more interesting things we've seen, I mean, there are the traditional partnerships with things like WISE and Boys and Girls Clubs, you know, and wherever those organizations are present, they should be capitalized on to partner with districts to run the afternoon portion of these programs. But we have a lot of partnerships with state parks or regional parks or even the Forest Service in California. So, you know, in some of our programs in the southern part of the Bay Area, there are state park rangers who come into the classroom to do science lessons. And then the next day, they'll take the kids out in field trips into state park facilities to places where these kids might not have ever been before. So the state parks have been an incredible resource, and there are state park facilities all over the place. The libraries are another. In San Mateo County, for example, the county library supports 9 school districts, and they run the afternoon portion of early literacy and also STEM programs for kids. And they hire college students from the area, and they train them to work in these programs as tutors and activity leaders. Colleges and universities are great assets. You know, one of the things that we're working on right now that we discovered as a new opportunity is to capitalize on all of the teachers in training up across our state, pre-service teachers, who have had no opportunity to get in-person classroom practice this past year because in California, most of our schools have been closed and many still are. And it's such a win-win to place these teachers in training in summer program roles to help staff those programs and get experience. There's also a robust network of private summer camps all over the place. These are camps that, you know, only some families can afford, but they typically have scholarship slots for low-income kids. And one of the things we're really encouraging school districts to consider, you know, with the additional resources they have, is that if they don't have the capacity to provide enriching summer experiences for kids because they're too busy and they're planning for fall, they can partner with some of these private camps to provide camp opportunities for young people that would be so exciting. I really think folks have to think out of the box around this. I mean, and, you know, Erin mentioned before, you know, museums, and there's all sorts of options, parks and recs, all sorts of options that districts can consider.
This is for anybody. Because there are so many more resources in the system now for this type of programming, what are some good ways that reporters can follow where the money is going, what can they ask for or about to sort of you know, do our due diligence and make sure that these funds are being spent, you know, on like the right kinds of partners? I mean, what kinds of things would you want to see if you're going to look at the books?
I'll jump in with a few thoughts on this. Well, first of all, I think finding the person in every community who is the liaison between the district and all these partnerships, that'll be the gold mine for you if I was a reporter, because that's going to be the person at the nexus of all of this. And we need more of those people. So just asking who that person is, if the district doesn't have that person, that's a red flag for them to create a role for that. Because, you know, I just saw in Baltimore Public Schools, they're holding a series of webinars for community groups to learn about what their plans are, how to access the funding, how to partner. Other than that, a lot of the out of school time groups are like, who do I call? Where do we go? We're here. We're ready. And just like Jen was saying, while some school districts and teachers are exhausted, a lot of these OST groups didn't get to run it fully and they're chomping at the bit. So we have a good mix and match opportunity. The other thing I'd ask is just about the number of kids you're going to be served. Ebony, that was very inspiring. I'm going to be talking about your school district and the demand and how many more students you could serve if you had more resources and everything else. But ultimately, you know, right now we're in a lot of the mechanics discussions. You know, where does the money go? Who's going to get it? Where's the evidence? And da, da, da. And ultimately, it's how many kids are we serving? And what's the plan for 2022, by the way? Do you have a goal with the resources you're getting to increase your numbers from 2021? Because I think everybody understands the challenges. But when we have a year to plan next summer, we've been asking for these investments. So now that we're going to get it, can we deliver for more kids and families? So I think just focusing on actual kids. And which innovative partnerships would be good questions to ask.
Aaron said something that made me think about some of the coordination work. Aaron Richards, you asked me a little earlier about like who's helping to pull this off. And so in addition, I just want to just add that as a result of a grant that we received about 4 to 5 years ago from the Wallace Foundation, we too have had the opportunity to really look at social and emotional learning as well as out of school time work. And RAND is our research firm that's really looking at the effectiveness of that. So when we first applied for that grant, we knew that we had to have what was called an intermediary for out of school time work. We started or launched into the Opportunity Project. So the Opportunity Project is exactly what, Aaron, you were mentioning, sir, regarding like who is that person that's really lobbying for more funds, who's ensuring that we look at this on a long-term, large-scale level. So I just wanted to add that, you know, the Opportunity Project, they're co-launching like a public website, the Tulsa City of Learning, where our families can literally get on and navigate the programs, the opportunities, the resources. So while they're doing that, they're also pushing for more funding and looking to see what other resources are out there so that we can sustain over the next few years. In addition to who's offering both during June and during August, how do we make sure that our students have just all those opportunities? And it's a lot to do. And I will just lastly say on this point that, you know, we happen to be in a state where unfortunately we're underfunded in Oklahoma. So the challenge is real regarding funds to continue to do this work for our young people. So we're continuously talking to the city of Tulsa around how do we make this a part of our city's budget? How do we continue to fund this where it's not necessarily just sitting on the shoulders of a school district? So just wanted to add that and just say that all those things will play a part in how we even move into the fall and run our school year.
That was Ebony Johnson, Chief Learning Officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma Public Schools. She was joined by Jennifer Peck from the Partnership for Children and Youth and Aaron Philip Dworkin, CEO of the National Summer Learning Association. This panel discussion on summer learning was part of the Education Writers Association's national seminar and was moderated by Aaron Richards of USA Today. Being a good teacher means knowing how to tell a good story. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
There's always a place for stories in academia. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Andrea Baldwin, lecturer in communication, explains why storytelling is important in any field.
The Storytellers is a platform organization that serves to create in-house, student-led, original performance work. From its inception in 2016, the Storytellers have served to consistently create original or adapted pieces for presentation on campus and at nationally attended conferences and festivals. This story navigates narrative structure in medias res of how an institution recommits to performance studies after a long absence and the social therapeutic benefits that develop in the process. The university's downward expansion, reforming the school from only serving junior and seniors to a four-year institution, opened the institution for opportunities dependent on student interest and instructor investment to create self-sustaining programs on campus. This autoethnographic narrative marks the process of what it means to start anew with performance studies at an institution with limited resources, and how the challenges of grassroots resourcing lend itself to healing and rejuvenating an academic community after Hurricane Harvey and beyond. Performance at its rebirth at this institution lends itself to self-healing, the community, relying on galvanizing others, and incorporating many talents to make stake for the arts at a STEM institution. This organization's implementation into this STEM-heavy institution ultimately turns our institution from STEM to STEAM, adding the A for arts. Although we are not traveling this year, as the organization pivots to adjust to COVID-19, we adjust to a digital experience. The organization continues to adapt and evolve as we adjust to a pandemic experience.
That was Andrea Baldwin of the University of Houston, Clear Lake. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.